The UK has chosen a path between Washington and Beijing amid the global dispute over Huawei. The Chinese telecoms giant will be allowed to build some less critical parts of Britain's next-generation 5G mobile phone network. That is despite US allegations that Huawei colludes with Chinese spies, allegations the firm has always denied. Washington has barred Huawei from any role in its 5G networks, and it wants allies to do the same.
Ford Motor revealed Friday it's the subject of a Justice Department criminal probe, the automaker's emissions certification process coming under scrutiny by the nation's top legal authority. Earlier this year, Ford voluntarily revealed to regulators that there may be errors in the calculations used to translate test results into the mileage and emissions data it submitted. Ford reiterated Friday that it is not using so-called defeat devices to cheat on emissions standards.
Amazon is disrupting the retail world again as it ups the ante in delivery speed. For Amazon Prime members, the e-commerce giant plans to roll out one-day shipping service as the default instead of the current 2 days. That announcement came with its blockbuster earnings report on Thursday, and by Friday, it hit shares of retailers like Target and Walmart hard.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Monday. It's April 29th, 5:09 in the morning. Thank you for tuning in to another edition of The Opening Bell. We've got another business day and another business week getting underway here, and lots going on in the world of business this morning. News about the Boeing 737 MAX and Southwest Airlines. We've got market numbers from around the world, and we'll get to those momentarily. And on the program today, we have the CEO Spotlight. We do that on Mondays. And Natalie Schmulek is here from the Hatchery in Chicago. It's one of Chicago's newest incubators, business incubators, this one focusing on food and beverage. Natalie is in the PPG Paints Green Room. She'll be up first this morning at about 2 minutes or so from right now. A little bit later in the program, you've probably heard the controversy over the census, the 2020 census. What impact might the question about citizenship have on policymakers and even the economy? We'll ask that of Professor Jay McCann at about 5:38 this morning. He is from Purdue University and knows all things census. That'll be our conversation in the second half of the program today. But first, let's begin on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. The NASDAQ and S&P 500 are at fresh all-time highs as Wall Street gets back to business today. There wasn't much movement in the major indices on Friday, but it was enough to hit the new milestone. Before the opening bell, the Commerce issued a report that showed GDP was growing faster than expected, but spending slowed down. This morning, as we look at the market numbers, futures are pointing toward a flat open when Wall Street rings at 8:30 Chicago time. Dow futures up just a fraction. Everything else is negative. As we look around the rest of the globe, in Europe, in London, Germany, and France, markets are lower by about a quarter of a percent to a third. And in Asia, the Nikkei closed today because of a holiday in Japan. Everything else mixed. The Hang Seng up nearly a percent. The Shanghai down nearly three quarters of a percent. And crude oil is trading at $62.84 a barrel, which is down about 45 cents. Some stories today making business headlines. Boeing did not tell Southwest Airlines, its largest 737 MAX customer, that a standard safety feature designed to warn pilots about malfunctioning sensors had been deactivated on the jets. The safety feature is an alert that lights up in the cockpit of the plane's angle of attack sensors when they transmit faulty data about the pitch of the plane's nose. That feature is known as an angle of attack disagree light, and was included in the previous version of the 737. Southwest did not know about the change until after the fatal crash of the Lion Air flight in Indonesia. And speaking of Boeing and the 737 MAX, the CEO, Dennis Muilenburg, will face shareholders today for the first time since those two deadly crashes forced the grounding of the aviation giant's 737 MAX. Muilenburg will try to convince investors they can be confident in the future of the company and its fastest-selling plane. He'll also hold a news conference after the shareholders' meeting scheduled for 9 o'clock this morning in Chicago. The 737 MAX has been grounded since March 10th. The crash that killed 157 people in Ethiopia, that was less than 5 months after the crash in Indonesia that killed 189 people on board. And Uber is setting a price range for its initial public offering of $45 to $50 a share. That would give the company a market cap as high as nearly $84 billion. The company hoping to raise $10 billion in its debut on the New York Stock Exchange. Price range is lower than many analysts expected. On Friday, PayPal announced it was investing about $500 million in Uber. In the first quarter of this year, Uber reported revenue of $3 billion. It reported a net loss of $1 billion. The company expected to go public next month. We begin this morning front and center with our CEO spotlight here on the opening bell. Chicago's newest business incubator is cooking up some innovation in the food and beverage industry. The Hatchery's Natalie Schmulek is in our spotlight this morning. Natalie, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I've been excited to have our conversation today because the idea of the hatchery is one that I think Chicago has been asking for. We have all kinds of incubators, but not one focused on food and restaurants.
Yeah, we're very excited about what we're doing. We know that Chicago is a staple for food and beverage, whether it be amazing restaurants throughout the city, amazing resources, agriculture, the foundation for so many big CPG companies. And we're excited to share alongside great incubators and accelerators like Good Food Business Accelerator and so many others here in Chicago that are doing great work for the food and beverage industry.
As the CEO, you are overseeing all of this. What have been the challenges and some of the things that you've had to get over to get to this point?
I think some of the biggest challenges have just been ensuring that what we're doing is, in fact, meeting a need. And that was very important to us from the beginning. We wanted to be able to learn alongside the entrepreneurs that we serve. And so we had this great concept, which was really the brainchild of ICNC, Industrial Council of Near West Chicago, which is one of the oldest and largest business incubators in the country, right here in Chicago in Fulton Market District, and Axion, the nonprofit microlender. And they knew there was a need just based off of what ICNC was seeing in their manufacturing space. They were seeing an influx of food and beverage entrepreneurs that just couldn't find food-grade production space. And that was a big challenge here. And we know there's so many brilliant minds, so we needed to give them a space to be able to have an outlet to develop their concepts and launch their products. So I think just ensuring that the building we were building was, in fact, what was needed. So really understanding the design, understanding all the elements of the architecture, the build-out. I do not have a background in building, so I think for me that was a huge challenge, but a great learning opportunity. I've learned so much about, far more about electricity and measurements than I ever wanted to, but I think it was really important because these are all elements that go into making an efficient space for a food and beverage producer.
Walk us through the space, if you will, for kind of virtually give our listeners a tour of what it looks like and what kinds of resources are there.
So we have a 67,000 square foot facility. It houses 55 private food grade production spaces and a large shared kitchen. So most food and beverage entrepreneurs get their start in a shared kitchen. It allows you to rent by the hour so you don't have as much overhead early on. It gets you in a kitchen, you can test your concept, and you can legally produce and sell your product. In addition, we have private kitchen spaces. Those are really valuable. Those are the areas that we found there was just a huge gap in the industry, is giving somebody a space that they have access to 24/7 where they could grow their business. In addition, we also have a culinary training center run by Chef Rick Bayless, a big, well-known chef here in Chicago. He's done so much for the city and for the food industry as a whole. He was very passionate about this project because for him, he saw there were challenges in the food service world where there's a big turnover right now with employment, finding talent, finding skilled laborers and chefs that can come into the kitchen and stick around and help build the business. And he also wanted to give back to the community and help underserved youth that maybe just didn't have the best luck in traditional education systems and wanted an opportunity to learn a viable skill set. So we've got this great culinary training center there. In addition to that, we have a beautiful event space with windows looking into the shared kitchen. So we've been getting a lot of event inquiries, which we're excited about because we know the space just has a really cool energy to it. You can feel the innovation and excitement excitement just going on in the space there. And that event space also works as a co-working space. Another major pain point we found for food and beverage entrepreneurs was you're getting into a kitchen, you're doing production, and then you have nowhere to do your administrative work. You have nowhere to sit down and jump on your laptop. So you're either going home, you're renting out space from a co-working area. So we wanted to provide that in-house where you can get out of your kitchen. You have a space where you can connect with your fellow entrepreneurs, grab lunch, hang out. The space is so beautifully lit. There's windows throughout the entire facility that just lightens up the space. And then we have a dedicated co-working space, which is more private, so that if anybody just needs to sit down and get to work, they have that option. We have a few meeting rooms and a conference room that all the entrepreneurs can book out. So if they have investor meetings, team meetings, they have all those capabilities. We have two phone booths if they need some privacy. And we share the space with one of our founding parent companies, Axion. They moved their operations into the hatchery. So we've got this amazing nonprofit microlender on site. And one of the things I'm really excited about is we have this beautiful plaza out front where we'll be hosting the Garfield Park Community Council's neighborhood market. And that's going to be an exciting feature because that market has done immense things for the neighborhood. We are located right at Lake and Kedzie in East Garfield Park. So the great thing from a transportation standpoint, you get off right at the Green Line stop and you come and you're right at our facility. But being in that neighborhood was very important to us because as a nonprofit, we really wanted to serve West Side community residents. There's so much untapped potential there. There are so many great things already going on. So we just wanted to be an advocate, a good neighbor, a good supporter. So we have a lot of programming that is open and available to community residents. We offer free classes for those looking to start a food and beverage company. We offer free membership, and we offer 34 hours of free shared kitchen use time per week, which is really important for those who typically just don't get that opportunity. And in addition, Axion is there to support businesses of all kinds, not just food and beverage.
You mentioned the neighborhoods and the targeting of that and why it's important for you to be there. Can you give us some examples of how it's helping on a sort of a personal level or a real level? Give us an example of how this is helping.
Yeah, I think the biggest area we've seen our value added is particularly to those who have food and beverage businesses right now in Garfield Park. There's some incredible entrepreneurs that are producing in their home kitchens, basements, churches, and frankly, they're not able to legally produce and sell their product, and mostly because they just can't afford it. So we've seen an immense amount of food and beverage entrepreneurs come to us and realize that we're able to walk them through the steps and we help guide them through what questions they should be asking. Because a lot of times you just don't know what questions you should ask to launch a food and beverage business. So we've already been able to get local community residents into the shared kitchen producing. We've been able to help them open accounts. Some of these individuals were just selling to their neighbors. They're now actually selling in stores. They're getting catering gigs from a lot of the companies that come into our space. We actually have a policy where if you do want to rent any kind of event space or the conference rooms, you would have to purchase your food and beverage from one of our member companies. And so a lot of times this is business going right back to community residents, to local producers, and that's something we're extremely excited about. And we've seen such a great response from that and from those who just attend our classes and express how grateful they are for the time we've saved them, the instruction we provide them. And just seeing the community to come together is amazing. We've hosted a few of the community markets in the space already. And it's so nice to see everybody have a space where they can congregate, they can meet entrepreneurs, and they can sample and purchase locally produced products.
Very exciting. Can you talk to us a little bit about the importance of having so many different players involved here? Like, for instance, the city with the tax breaks, the corporations that are helping, community leaders that are helping. I mean, it's all sort of a big team effort, isn't it?
It is. And that's something we're really excited about. And we really integrated that into our mission early on, is this facility and this organization is about collaboration. And we know if we're going to see real change in this industry, in this city, in this country, it's really about everybody coming together and working with one another. So we're thrilled that so many supporters came out to help this project come to life. And that includes the city. The city has been a major supporter of ours from day one. We've had amazing organizations throughout Chicago that have stepped in and wanted to see both the support for the community, the support for food and beverage entrepreneurs, and want to see Chicago continue to be and flourish as the hub for food and beverage innovation. And we couldn't be more thankful for our corporate partners as well, our fiscal partners, Kellogg Company, ConAgra, Griffith Foods. In addition to them, we have so many local companies that have come into the space who are excited to give back. We actually have two kitchen tenants. Ingredion is on site, and they're there to provide support, whether it be support with ingredients, technical aspects of formulating your products. We also have Synergy Flavors on site. Our X Bar has a space. So these are groups coming together, and it's exciting to not just see everybody come together to support the hatchery, but everybody coming together to support one another. Because we know that when the entrepreneurs work together, amazing things happen. When the entrepreneurs partner with some of these larger corporations, they both learn from one another. And then with these large corporations partnering with one another, you can see amazing innovation and things come to life where we flip the lens away from competition and really into collaboration. And I think that's what's going to open the door for so many new opportunities.
How do you measure your success? Is it the number of new companies that you help get going? Is it the number of new jobs that are created, or all of the above?
I'd say it's certainly a combination. Jobs created is very important to us. We've set a very aggressive goal of 900 jobs over the next 5 years. And in addition to that, we do look at each and every entrepreneur. We don't just necessarily look at who's launched a business and who has the most successful business, but we also look at the individual and see how we may have helped them. A lot of times we have entrepreneurs come to us that have a business idea but don't have the capacity to successfully launch a sustainable business. And so for us, it's equally a success when we help guide an entrepreneur into a different path versus having them invest their life savings into an idea that we know will likely not go anywhere. So we do encourage the people who come to us to think about entrepreneurship a little bit differently, knowing that you don't necessarily have to be the entrepreneur or the founder to be entrepreneurial. There's ways to partner with existing companies where they can benefit from your skill set, and you have a much safer opportunity of working with a business that has more of a sustainable opportunity in the industry. But we do track a lot of metrics, and that's something we're always learning about, and we're excited to learn from our partners on what the best way to track these metrics are. And so that's something we're constantly building, to your point, whether it be about the success of the business, revenue generated, jobs created, money saved, time saved. These are all things we're constantly exploring.
It's almost like the spoke in the wheel of entrepreneurship, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Talk to us a little bit about your background. You operated your own restaurant. You have a background educationally in food and beverage. What is it in your past that has prepared you to be the CEO at this moment?
That's a great question. I think a lot of it has just been great experiences and opportunities that have presented themselves along the way. I always find that we have a bit of a stigma around this idea of jack of all trades, master of none. But I truly believe that in this industry, you have to be a jack of all trades to master the one. And that's something that I spent a lot of time on early on. I knew I wanted to learn about this industry. I knew I wanted to understand every aspect. I think it was important for me to go through the experience of being an entrepreneur, launching my own business, and going through the ebbs and flows of what it means to be a business owner, because I can sympathize greatly with the entrepreneurs that we work with. And I understand the challenges that come with that, including oftentimes emotional challenges, isolation, not having the right community in place. And that's something that I set my sights on early on, was finding a way to support this entrepreneurial community by just creating an environment where everybody can feel comfortable and share their insights and connect with one another to help ease the journey a little bit more. But I think I always had a passion for food and beverage. I've always loved cooking, and I always knew there was something more to it. Early on, when I was looking into what the opportunities were in the industry, it was really, you're a chef or you're working in a supermarket. There were limited opportunities available. So after I launched the restaurant, I wanted to learn about supermarkets and how that operation works. So I spent a lot of time doing consumer education for a supermarket chain. Then wanted to go back to school, so I did my master's in gastronomy, which I think to this day people still don't quite know what it is.
It sounds cool.
It sounds cool. You can kind of turn it into whatever you want it to be. And then I had an opportunity to work in cookbook publishing and social media and marketing for the food industry, and then had a chance to work with my first consumer packaged goods company, which is now called EVT. They're based in Boston. They're expanding rapidly. Loved that experience. And I think I fell in love with the early stages of that business and the hustle of what it means to get from point A to point B. And that's where I wanted to discover more and see how I could help entrepreneurs in those stages of their business.
If there is such a thing, are there food and hub cities in the country? And do you think Chicago is one of those places that makes the hatchery a perfect fit here?
Absolutely. Without question, Chicago is one of the best cities right now for food and beverage and will continue to be so. We already see that with the amount of consumer packaged goods companies setting up their headquarters here. We see that with the incubators launching. We see that with food halls and restaurant concepts and all sorts of innovation really coming out of Chicago. And I think it's the perfect ecosystem right now. I think we've got all of the players in place. We've got all of the resources that these companies need. We've seen great success, which excites me. We've seen companies like RX Bar and Vital Proteins and Simple Mills. We've seen so many great successful companies come out of Chicago. And I think it's the prime opportunity right now for anybody looking to launch a business to launch here in Middle America, where from a distribution standpoint, it's also a great opportunity for them.
If you had a crystal ball, where would you like to see the hatchery in 5 or 10 years?
That's a great question. I would like to, without question, see the hatchery thrive, but I would like to see the hatchery also be the staple for food and beverage incubation. It's important for us to really set the ground rules and ensure, first and foremost, food safety. We're always learning every day about regulations, about requirements to ensure that this facility, this large facility that we're running, maintains standards and ensures that everything that comes out of the facility is food safe, is the highest quality, and is produced with care and thought every step of the way. So I want to be able to share those insights with others developing either a similar concept or trying to improve on existing concepts and models that they have. I think that in 5 years, certainly I want to see us meet all of our goals with job creation. I want to see our community thrive. I want to see more urban gardens. I want to see more markets. I want to see more support for local food and beverage companies. I want our space to be a foundation where people can come together and help one another. But I'd love to also see so many of the companies that will come out of and graduate from the hatchery become extremely successful and continue to rise, whether it be through partnering with big corporations or through developing their own facilities and continuing to grow that way.
And people who are listening who may think that they want to get involved somehow, What's the best way for them to do that?
There are several ways. Certainly going on our website is a great place to find information on how to get involved, www.thehatcherychicago.org. We have a list of events. We run one or two seminars and workshops a week, and it's open to everybody. So if somebody wants to just come and learn about an aspect of the food and beverage industry, they are welcome to do so. We also have monthly networking events. That's a great way to connect up with the local community, with entrepreneurs in the space, with supporters and service providers. And then we also have opportunities to join as members, whether it be entrepreneur members, network members. And for anyone just looking to launch their business and they're not quite sure where to start, we have our monthly Starting a Food Business class as well.
Okay. And there's a tab, events, on your website, and there's a whole list of things coming up.
Yes. Yeah. We're very excited. And last week we had our official grand opening for the Hatchery Chicago. It was an incredible event. It was so wonderful to see all these companies and supporters come together, and we're excited to host many more events like it.
Well, Natalie, it's wonderful meeting you. All the best to everybody at the Hatchery.
Thank you so much.
Natalie Schmulek, the CEO of the Hatchery in Chicago. We're going to continue our conversation with Natalie after the bell this morning and post that in the podcast of the opening bell a little bit later on this morning. And don't forget to check them out online at thehatcherychicago.org.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning again, everyone. Welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here with us on our Monday edition of The Opening Bell. The U.S. Supreme Court's conservative majority has heard arguments on adding a citizenship question to the 2020 census.
And the people who read tea leaves say it appears that the court is getting ready to side with President Trump on this matter, even though some say this could be a disaster for policy and even the economy. Joining us this morning is Professor Jay McCann. He's a professor of political science and co-coordinator of advanced methods at Purdue University. Professor McCann, good morning. Welcome to the opening bell.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for the invitation.
This is a conversation I think a lot of people have been having in recent days and weeks. Let's kind of tell people where we stand right now. I mentioned the Supreme Court heard arguments on this. They're going to be the deciders, apparently. It sounds like they're leaning in the side of putting this on the census.
That's right. I think as much as one can infer by the kinds of questions that come up during these conversations, it does look like they're leaning that way, mostly kind of leaning towards giving the Trump administration wide discretion to do this.
Has there ever been a citizenship question on the census before, and why is this such a big deal?
Yeah. Well, just to remind everybody, every 10 years, everybody living in this country is asked to respond to what's called the short form of the census. So like half a dozen questions asking how many people live here, you know, what's your ethnic background, that kind of stuff. The last time a citizenship question was asked on the short form was 1950, so it's been quite some time.
The people who put together the census and others like yourself suggest that there is going to be a large number of people who don't answer this question because they are not citizens. Is that a fair way to describe what the fear is here?
Yeah. It's hard to say in advance. This is a tough thing to forecast, and there hasn't been a lot of kind of preliminary research to see the risks of that. But there have been lots of different studies and academics to suggest that, yeah, you know, if you put on that item, then you're going to kind of breed a sense of distrust. You might see, maybe a reduction of, say, 10% of response rates just because of that item as a rough guesstimate.
10%, that's a high number, isn't it?
Yeah, it would be a high number. And you use the word disaster. From a policymaking standpoint, it's really important to get as exact a count as you can, right? Because lots of resources go into doing the census and a lot of decisions are made based on that kind of data. So you want to get it as right as possible.
From an economic standpoint, we do that here on this program. If we don't have an accurate count of the number of people in the United States, economists say that we will lose. There will be less money going to some federal programs, maybe student loans impacted by this, Section 8 housing, the economy, other parts of the economy could be negatively affected by not knowing how many people are in the United States.
Yeah, that's one of the risks, not only from a government policymaking standpoint, but also, you know, a lot of business planners use census data. It's a public resource, right? So when you're forecasting your own decisions, that can be a real useful database.
Yeah, and one of those CEOs, the CEO of the Nielsen company, David Kenney, recently, he was one of the people who was on the side of folks who are urging the Supreme Court not to put this question on the census. He says that this could be not just a disaster, but a catastrophe for business.
Well, yeah, it may well be. And to circle back to the point about, you know, how much should we expect the undercount to be, you know, we're really in a very gray area here. Surveys suggest as much as maybe 10% of potential respondents might be, you know, extra skeptical about responding. There have been experiments done to show other percentages. So we really are kind of flying blind a little bit on all of this.
You have had a past in your past. Part of your career has been serving Latino populations. Do you think that there's a chance that what we're talking about here is a little bit of hyperbole, or what is your personal history involving these questions being asked and responses given?
Sure. Yeah, I have conducted lots of surveys among Latinos, including foreign-born Latinos, and you can, in fact, ask them about citizenship status. I mean, this is something that individuals are aware of, and they will respond validly in the context of a survey, but social researchers need to work real hard to establish trust in the first place. So, you know, that would involve conducting lengthy interviews, getting to know your survey subject, you know, reinforcing this kind of rapport that you have. You know, the census is just not set up to do that. You know, you'll get something in the mail or on email, and if you don't respond, then an enumerator may come, and there's this kind of implicit sanction that if you don't do this, then you might be fined, for instance. So it's very unlike a social science research project.
You mentioned the trust part of this, and that's at the crux of what I think our conversation is about this morning. There's this idea that if I answer on the census that I'm not an American citizen, if that question makes it on the census, that something will happen to me. What's the privacy around the census? What is the chance of something like that happening?
Yeah, well, there are hard guardrails, you know, to protect the data. I mean, administratively, the census raw information is not to be shared with any other agency or anything on paper. Okay, so the current practice is to really protect confidentiality. That being said, when you look at just general impressions among Americans, but especially immigrants and especially Latino Americans, there's a lot of skepticism out there about whether those administrative laws are going to be followed. And given the high stakes with a vulnerable population, right, who might worry about getting stigmatized, it's natural to expect that, you know, there's going to be some wariness about responding.
You know, we're talking about the census question as if it were a one-off that's just going to happen at one point in our history. But the answers and the results of the census could impact us for another decade. I think that's why this has so much interest and weight for people.
Oh, yeah. In this country, the census is one of the most significant data sets that we have for all kinds of planning purposes. And the Constitution mandates only every 10 years, right? So if we get an exact count this time around, we're going to have to wait a while before we correct that down the line.
Do you have any advice for the Census Bureau if this really happens, them to sort of make sure that more people are counted and take part in this? What kind of work has to be done before we actually get these forms in the mail?
Yeah, well, time is really short. I mean, ideally, if you were going to do this, you'd want to do lots of pre-testing to see, you know, what kinds of people are less likely to respond. And you'd want to engage in a really significant public information campaign to reassure people that, look, you know, it's okay to respond. And you'd also have to invest an awful lot. I don't know how much investment they've done at this point in hiring the extra staff who are going to have to go out into the communities, because you would expect that there's going to be a big personnel burden out there. You know, if there is non-response, then you're going to have to send out, you know, on a case-by-case basis to all these different places to try and get a better count. So it's just, God, it's a daunting task when you think about it, given the real short time horizon.
Yeah, and there's something, too, called the American Community Survey that will be impacted by the census as well. Talk to us a little bit about that. What's the American Community Survey?
Yeah, the American Community Survey is an annual kind of subset. So think of it as, you know, a very small version of the census that doesn't have the big numbers on it, but it does have a much longer form attached to it. And so for instance, for a lot of business planning purposes and policy purposes, they ask all kinds of items that wouldn't appear on the short form, you know, having to do with marital status or, you know, income profile, things like that. Okay, so that's been a very rich data set for folks, and that is a subset of the census. Okay, so anything that sort of would depress participation in the census might have a ripple effect across related databases.
Well, Professor McCann, we appreciate you being on with us this morning and giving us a little bit of insight into what's happening here. I guess all eyes now will just be on the Supreme Court and see how they come down on all of this.
Yes. Well, happy to talk with you.
Professor Jay McCann from Purdue University, Professor McCann of Political Science, also co-coordinator of the Advanced Methods Lab at Purdue University.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
On the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk, futures pointing toward a flat to negative open on Wall Street. The Dow futures off 2 points this morning. NASDAQ and S&P futures off a fraction each as well. Now, agriculture and commodities. Good morning, Orion Samuelson.
Good morning, Steve. Well, I can tell you some of the main topics of conversation at rural coffee shops over the weekend. First of all, the fact that winter is making a comeback when it should be springtime, but some parts of the Midwest got up to 10 inches of snow over the weekend, a heavy, wet snow that was melting quickly. But with that is a forecast for rain for this week. And the concern now is what the snow that accumulated, while it melts fairly rapidly, because it'll be nearly 60 degrees, but in the Midwest, that melting snow may not be welcomed by farmers who for months have been facing devastation from ruined crops and drowned livestock. And that's going to be in the picture for quite a while. The other topic of conversation at coffee shops this weekend, the fact that biofuels pioneer Archer Daniels Midland is stepping back in the biofuels ethanol industry. ADM on Friday said it may spin off three large dry mills, which primarily produce only ethanol, after unsuccessfully searching for a buyer for those mills since 2016. But they saw their quarterly earnings report show a 41% drop in the first quarter. And apparently ethanol and the challenge it's facing, not only in the U.S., but in the world, is cutting deeply into the profit of companies involved in ethanol. So we'll hope we get drier weather this week and the planting get underway seriously. We'll watch the report this afternoon. Don't expect it to show much progress. You have a great day. I'm Orion Samuelson.
Thanks, Orion. You as well. A couple of more headlines before we leave you this morning. A survey of corporate economists predict the economy will expand over the next year, but more slowly. Just 53% of the economists polled for the National Association of Business Economics April survey released today expect the economy to grow by more than 2% this year, down from 67% who felt that way in January. The results from the survey released today again suggest a sharp slowdown, with employers facing pressure to raise wages, spend more on worker training, and automate tasks because of the low unemployment rate. Marvel is conquering the universe. Avengers Endgame shattered the record for biggest opening weekend with an estimated $350 million in ticket sales domestically and $1.2 billion globally, reaching a new pinnacle in the blockbuster era that the comic book studio has come to dominate. To accommodate demand, the Walt Disney Company released Endgame in more theaters, 4,600 of them in the U.S. and in Canada. That's more than any opening before. Now the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk outlook for Monday, April 29th. Reports on personal income and spending are due today. Analysts see personal income picking up 0.4%. They're forecasting a 0.7% increase in spending. The numbers will be released at mid-morning. We'll also get that Boeing shareholder meeting today and Boeing news conference in Chicago at about 9 o'clock Chicago time. Also, Eurozone economic sentiment numbers due out today on the earnings calendar. Spotify, Alphabet, Kemper Financial, and CNA all reporting quarterly earnings today. Just some of the things that could move the markets on this Monday, April the 29th.